Good afternoon. So, last time we started off by looking, reviewing in this case, combining forwarding with stalling. So you mentioned, well, forwarding solved a lot of our problems with data hazards, but it didn't always work. And the example in our five-stage pipeline was that when we access memory and then try to run an instruction which needed the value for memory in the execute stage, well, we couldn't actually do that without some amount of stalling. But forwarding allows us to do only one cycle of stalling in that case, instead of stalling a few extra cycles to wait for that value for memory to be written back. And with other pipelines, we might have more situations like that, depending on what way we divide the processor up into stages. But we'll always have this general strategy of doing enough stalling to make forwarding work. And that's still likely to be a lot more efficient than if we were only using stalling to resolve our data hazards. Then we talked about control hazards. So we kind of glossed over, when we start to introduce pipelining, what are we going to do about instructions like conditional jump or return, where, well, when we combined our fetch and PC update stage, it seemed that we wanted to do the work of those instructions in the fetch stage, but using values that wouldn't be available until the execute or the memory stages. And this was what we call the control hazard. We didn't know what instruction to fetch at all. When we did our normal setting up of our pipelines, we have to do something special to handle it, and forwarding's not going to work because the value wasn't computed yet. So stalling was a valid solution. But for conditional jumps, we had a better solution. So we could just stall and always waste a few cycles every time you have a conditional jump. But rather than actually just letting those cycles go to waste, we had an alternate idea, which was we could just make a guess. We could guess what the outcome is. And our best case is that our guess is correct, and we just do no extra work. We do the same work we do for an unconditional jump. It's not a big deal. But if the guess is wrong, of course, well, it's going to be a little more complicated. But it turns out it's not going to be that much more complicated. We just need to correct for a wrong guess by doing two things. One big thing is that, well, we fetched some instructions we shouldn't have fetched. So we need to undo the effect of those instructions. And we learned that, well, if they haven't gotten too far in our pipeline, that just means we just eliminate them from our pipeline registers by replacing them with nums. We call this squashing those instructions. And the second thing we need to do is we need to actually fetch the correct thing, just like we would if we were stalling. Okay. So any questions about the things we covered last time? I'm going to go over some of the things on the quiz, because people in the morning lecture asked about that. So I assume people here would be interested too. But other than that, questions about things we covered last time? Yes? Okay, so your question is that you've heard that branch prediction has been related to exploits where that branch prediction somehow leaks information. So the branch prediction we've talked about in this class generally hasn't relied on any sort of state. Like, our branch prediction is always, we look at the instruction, we know what the prediction we're going to make is. Now, that design is not what real processors have used, at least since like the mid-90s, at least not desktop sort of laptop class processors, because it's not good enough at predicting. Like, you can make a reasonable guess in that sort of way, but to make a much better guess, we want to use some dynamic information. So what that dynamic information might be is, what are the outcomes of recent branches that look similar, where similar often means have a similar PC. And so this means that we'll have some state about recent branches, which will affect the behavior of programs, which will affect how long programs take to run. And And where this has become a security problem is that often that state has been shared between code which should be, you know, secure, like operating system code, and code which isn't, you know, supposed to be trusted in that way, like application code you're running in a web browser page. And so that's the sort of reason why we've had concerns about exploits there. It's been related to that. That's one reason. So another reason why is, when we talked about squashing, all we were doing was getting rid of pending instructions. In more modern processors, well, we want to do prediction where it's going to take longer to resolve those instructions than just long enough for them to just start the execute stage. And what that means is that in that case, there might be some side effects of the instructions that will persist and affect timing. So one of those side effects will be in caches. So the instructions will affect caches. And from that, you can sort of infer what the instructions that weren't supposed to run did. And that often violates assumptions people might have when they're writing OSs. They might assume that, you know, you'll never learn information about stuff in this if branch that shouldn't have executed, but you might, in fact, do that. So we're not going to go into, I guess, most likely, we're not going to have time to go into, like, real detail about those vulnerabilities. But they're sort of things that arise when you aren't careful in how you do more sophisticated versions of branch prediction and squashing. Okay. So other questions or follow-ups, comments? So on the quiz, I had several questions this morning about, can you go over the quiz questions? So between this morning's lecture and this lecture, I prepared some slides so I don't have to look up the quiz questions and frantically ad lib. So let's first talk about quiz question one. So this question was asking, you know, where there would be data hazards. And a lot of people apparently looked at that question and said, oh, well, this processor you described in this question, it has forwarding, so we've gotten rid of those data hazards. So that's not the definition of a data hazard. So data hazard is always about, before we've done anything special besides just set up our pipeline, is there a problem? So if we have to do stalling, we may have made the data hazard not cause incorrect behavior, but there still is a data hazard. And when we have to do forwarding, the same is true. We've made the data hazard not cause an incorrect behavior, but we still had to do something to do that. There was a data hazard that was exercised by that code on that processor. So questions about this idea of the difference between, you know, a data hazard existing versus, you know, whether we've dealt with it to cause correct behavior. Okay, so then there was a question on quiz question three. We had our load user hazard in this processor. And some people wanted it to be the case that, oh, we can bind the memory and write back stage. Doesn't that mean that our memory access finishes before the stage is done, so we're fine? And the answer is no, because if we don't stall here, so if we don't stall like I'm showing here, or I'm repeating the decode stage, then we'd be getting, at best, the result of our memory access halfway through the execute stage. And, you know, we're going to usually assume that that's not going to be okay, because that implies that the execute stage is, like, you know, longer, much, much longer than it needs to be, and we divided things up poorly. Like, usually our assumption is, if there's an execute stage, we need things near the beginning. We can't, like, have them more than halfway through, which is kind of what's implied by this memory and write-back stage, if we wait till after the memory access happens. So questions about this? Yes?
Can we fetch stage instead of decode?
Question is, could I repeat the fetch stage instead of the decode? Yes. So I think in a typical implementation, we wouldn't do that because it's going to be easier to write the logic to detect if we need to stall after we've done our computations of the source and destination registers we do for the code stage anyways. Other questions? So on question four, a lot of people had questions about the forwarding to IR move queue. So people said, oh, IR move queue, RB is R9. And you remembered, oh, I'm going to do this check. Does register B that we're reading from equal the destination register or some other instruction? I'm going to say we have to forward. And our answer was that we shouldn't expect forwarding to happen. And, well, the reason why we shouldn't expect forwarding to happen is because the IR move queue doesn't actually need to read the instruction. So there shouldn't be a reason to have forwarding happen. Now, it wouldn't actually be broken to forward that value. But generally, we're going to want to distinguish these situations like IR move queue, where we don't actually want to read from a register in our pipeline processor for dealing with hazards. And for forwarding, it's not a problem. But if we were doing stalling. If we're doing stalling, this would be a problem. Because we don't want to stall because we need to wait for the value of R9. So usually in your implementation, you should arrange to set regsource B or whatever else you're going to use to figure out what register are we reading from for the purposes of dealing with stalling and forwarding to reg9 in this case. And it doesn't really matter if you do this for forwarding, but for stalling, you know, if you don't do this right, you'll stall when you don't need to. Your processor just runs slower for no reason. You could also say, oh, I'm going to still set regsource B to RB, and you could have some special case based on the I-codes. I don't recommend that. That seems like very error-prone because I'm going to forget some I-code does something and mess myself up. So questions about this issue with detecting, with not forwarding in this case? Okay, so then there were a lot of questions about numbers 5 and 6 on the quiz. So this was dealing with a processor where we split the execute stage, and we were asking about how conditional jumps worked using our strategy of, we'll predict them as always taken. And we stated in the question, and this was very important, that we wouldn't figure out whether a conditional jump should or should not happen until near the end of the execute to stage. So that means that our timeline for a conditional jump, this jump if less than equal foo, is that if that jump wasn't taken, we'd mispredict 3 instructions. The first one when the jump makes it to the decode stage, the second when it makes it to the execute one stage, and the third when it makes it to the execute two stage. Only after we fetch that third instruction will we figure out, oh, I actually wanted to fetch this other instruction, in this case, the XOR. And this means the XOR's memory stage, sorry, the XOR's fetch stage would line up with the jump's memory stage. And also that the write back stage of the add would have finished before the XOR needs to read from any of those registers. So we wouldn't do any forwarding. We just get the value from the register normally because we would have effectively stalled by having that misprediction and squashing happen. Okay. And here I'm sort of showing these instructions going away. But as we're going to discuss later today, what's really going to happen is they're going to be replaced with nums. Questions about this conditional jump scenario. Okay. So last time when we finished up, our last topic was about ways of doing 2 operations on pipeline registers. So one was an operation we called stall, which is kind of deceptive because, as we'll learn, what we call stalling an instruction involves more than just this operation. But the operation we called stalling a pipeline register was making the pipeline register output the same thing was already outputting. in the next cycle. Same thing is happening now. Outputs that in the next cycle. So basically, we had a mux that looked like this, that fed back the old value. And we mentioned that this was built into HTLRS as the stall and output capital letter name signal. And we had a mux that did what we called bubble, which was for inserting a pipeline bubble, which would be a NOP. And in HTLRS, this we had a bubble, capital letter of the register name signal for this, which would put in the default values. And the reason this would turn into a pipeline bubble is because we'd always make our default values be a NOP. We kind of have to do that anyways, because if we think of when the processor's starting, what should the write-back stage do in the first cycle? It better not write anything. So it should do what a NOP does. And same thing with all the other stages. They shouldn't do anything in the first stage except for the fetch stage. So we're going to have our default values be a NOP just naturally. And given that, we went through this example of sort of what mechanically happens to the register values with these signals. So questions on this before we try to apply this to instructions? Okay, so now let's think about applying these signals to instructions. So here I have a five-stage pipeline, and I'm saying at time one, I have instruction E in fetch, instruction D in decode, instruction C in execute, instruction B in memory, instruction A in write back. And I'm saying during time two, I want instruction E to be in fetch again. I want a no-op in decode, so I want a pipeline bubble in decode. I want instruction C to be in execute again. So I'm squashing instruction D and stalling instruction C. I want memory to have a no-op. That's sort of part of squashing instruction C. And I want memory to have instruction B. And my question here is, well, how do I set those stall and bubble signals on my pipeline registers? And I have arrows here representing each of the pipeline registers. So for example, here I have the register. This arrow here represents fetch to decode. So the corresponding signals for them will be stall D and bubble D, because it's always named after the output. And the question is, what should these be set during time one? So remember, we set the signals during cycle one to control what happens during cycle two. So I want to know that for fetch to decode, decode to execute, and so on. I also have pictured RPC register as something from fetch to fetch. We'll talk about that separately. So that's going to have a stall and a bubble signal. But there's a bunch of extra cases there with how do we deal with like the return address or conditional jumps after they're mispredicted. So we're going to talk about how we deal with that separately. And my recommendation, though many students don't do this, is to have just a mux to set the PC rather than relying on the stall signals as part of that, just because you have to deal with cases besides the stall and bubble case anyways. So exercise is for the fetch to decode, decode to execute, and so on. What should they be to make this happen? And our options are stall, normal, or bubble. So stall means stall that letter is true at one. Normal means they're both zero. Bubble means bubble that letter is one. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with fetch to the code. So who thinks that should be stall? So stall D should be set, bubble D should be clear. Who thinks that should be bubble? Okay, so it looks like we have consensus, and there's not enough people left to make a substantial number of you think it should be normal. So I agree with that. So we should have here. Okay, how about from decode to execute? Who thinks that should be set to stall? So stall E should be set, bubble E should be 0. How about to bubble? How about normal? Okay, so we have a bit of a split there. So if it was normal, if we had stall E 0, bubble E 0, what would we expect to happen? Well, we expect an instruction to advance from decode to execute. We look at our picture, that would say that instruction D would be in execute at time 2. That is not the case, so that must not be what we're doing. So if we're stopping an instruction from advancing, we're doing something else, and the other thing we're doing is we're keeping the same instruction. So C, which is previously being output by the execute registers, needs to be output again. So we're going to set stall E to true to make this happen. So this is going to be a stall, which is going to correspond to stall E equals 1. So this is saying at time 1, we're going to make, I should probably make it clearer that that's at time 1, we're going to say set stall E to true, so at time 2, C remains in the execute stage where it was before. Some questions on how I figured that out. Okay, so how about from execute to memory? Should it be a stall? Should it be normal? Should it be a bubble? Okay, we have consensus there. And memory to write back, should it be a stall? Should it be normal? Should it be a bubble? Okay, so we have consensus there. Okay, so that matches. Good. So let's do one or more. Here, this different example. And I will scratch out the no fetch to fetch, please. Give. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so fetch to decode, who thinks it's stall? Thinks it's normal? Okay, so who thinks it's bubble? Okay, so I think it's normal. We're passing the E instruction for fetch to decode. If we did stall, it would be, we'd keep D there. Decode to execute, who thinks it's stall? Thinks it's normal, bubble, okay. So I think it's stall, and I'll just go quickly since I think we have a reasonable idea about this, so we can go through other examples. So execute to memory, we want a NOP, so we're gonna set the memory bubble M during time 1 to true to make that happen, and memory to write back, or passing instruction B from memory to write back, so it's normal. Okay, so questions about this. So now that we know sort of how our stall and bubble signals that control these built-in muxes affect instructions, we can apply this to handling stalling in prediction. So this is going to be our tool for handling the sort of secondary part of dealing with stalling prediction, which is updating the pipeline registers. We need to sometimes keep an instruction in the same pipeline registers, and sometimes we need to make sure we have a NOP to replace an instruction that normally would advance. We're also going to have a piece we'll talk about later where we need to update the program counter, that we need to keep the program counter the same. So that's kind of like stalling. Or we need to use a predicted program counter instead of, you know, who knows what. Or when we have a misprediction, we need to somehow fetch the thing that we are meant to fetch instead of something from our mispredicted chain of instructions. So let's look at how those pipeline registers work for, first, a simple stall. So in this case, this is a stall for a load use hazard. So I'm fetching RBX from memory, or loading RBX from memory, and then using it in a subtract. And to make that happen, the subtract needs to stall for one cycle. And in this case, I've decided to detect that stall in the decode stage. So I'm going to repeat the fetch of the IR move queue. So we'll fetch the IR move queue, and then we'll realize, wait a moment, sorry, IR move queue, you can't move on. Now, note that something I need to do to make this work is I need to add a NOP. Why do I need to add a NOP? Because if I look at time 3, the execute stage needs something to do. If we don't do anything, what's the execute stage going to do? It's going to take values from decode. And so if we don't do anything, we're going to duplicate the subtract instruction. We'll have one copy in decode and one copy in execute. We definitely don't want that. We don't want magically multiplying instructions. We only want one of them. So to prevent that from happening, we're going to have to put a NOP in the execute stage. How are we going to do that? With our bubble signal. So it's part of stalling an instruction is going to involve both our stall and bubble signal. I would say that their textbook authors, therefore, made a mistake in naming the signal stall and bubble, but we're using their names to be consistent with them. You have a question?
Could you just explain again, like, why you need the NOP?
So why do we need the NOP? So if I don't do anything, what would happen is we'd have our subtract instruction would move from decode to execute. That's just normally what happens. And execute needs something to do. We have to put something in those registers feeding the execute stage. And we don't have any other work for the execute to do, so the only thing we can do is feed it a NOP. So that's what we're going to do. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So to implement this, what's this going to look like? So one thing we need to do is we need, during cycle 3, we need to repeat what was previously in fetch and decode. So to do this, during cycle 2, we're going to set this up. And how we're going to set it up, so for the fetch to decode registers, we're going to set the stall big D signal to 1 to say, decode stage, repeat what you were previously doing. And we want to do the same thing for the fetch stage. And for the fetch stage, we could do this like you kind of did for halt in PipeLab 1 by setting the stall capital F signal. I prefer just having a mux on the input to the PC register for this rather than relying on the built-in signal, just because it makes it easier for me to see how it interacts with our other cases for the PC. But both of these work, and both of these are solutions students have implemented for the upcoming pipelining homeworks. But we need to do something so the fetch stage fetches the same thing again. And we also need to make sure that the execute stage doesn't do something we don't want it to do, so we make sure it does a NOP by during cycle 2 again. In advance, we set up that it's going to do a NOP instead of doing the subtract like it would do without intervention. So questions about the signals we need here? Okay. So that's our stalling for load use. The other case we talked about was misprediction. So for misprediction, we're going to be fetching some predicted instructions and replacing them with knobs, like we saw earlier with our hypothetical six-stage pipeline. Here's it with our actual pipeline. So we need to replace them with knobs. How are we going to do that? We're going to use the bubble signal to say, hey, whatever you're passing from decode to execute, ignore it. And instead, during the execute stage, I want to have an op there. So this is going to correspond to setting bubble E and bubble D. At time 3. Because remember, we set these signals in advance of the cycle where we want them to take effect. Questions, how we deal with our, sorry, yeah.
Like bubble D is equal to 1?
1, sorry. The question is, what is bubble D equal to here? This is a 1, another 1. Since they're just Boolean signals. Other questions? Another way we could view this is we can look at sort of a diagram where I've drawn time vertically, and we're normally going to have all our signals set to have bubble install clear, but when we detect this misprediction, at the same time we figure out, oh, during the next cycle I want to fetch that XOR, I'm going to set the two bubble signals, so we pass on nothing instead of our mispredicted R move Q and add Q. Questions about this picture? So we know we want to set bubble D and bubble E. How might that look? Well, what we're going to end up doing, probably, is we can look at, oh, in the execute stage, is there a conditional jump? And is it a conditional jump we mispredicted? If we're predicting is always taken, was it not actually taken based on what we computed? And if so, that's the case where we want to set bubble D and bubble E. And in your processor, well, there's going to be other occasions where you're going to want to set bubble D and bubble E. We saw one of them in our load use hazard, where you want to sometimes make a pipeline bubble by setting bubble E. So we'll have a bunch of other cases, and you'll have to deal with all of them together. So you'll end up with code something like this. So questions on the sort of idea for what the HCL code would look like? Okay, so there's one stalling case we haven't dealt with yet and sort of explained how we're going to do in HCL, and that's return. So return, you know, we'd like to fetch the thing we're returning to right away, but we can't do that. We need to wait for the return to get all the way to the memory stage. And then after that, we can finally fetch the right thing. And our strategy for doing this is going to be, well, we're going to have to fetch something, but we want to ignore that. So we're going to fetch something, which I represented with a bunch of question marks. I would recommend fetching the return instruction again, but we don't care. Why don't we care? Because you're never going to pass what you fetch onto the decode stage. Instead, we're just going to pass a knob onto the decode stage, so it's going to be as if we ran a bunch of knobs and then finally fetched what the question mark instruction is meant to be, the actual return address. Questions about how this picture works? Yes, back there. Why can't we just fetch a knob? So that seems like an attractive option. The problem is we need to know the address of a knob. So you could hypothetically do something like have a mux on the output of the instruction memory to do that, but you can't actually fetch a knob unless you happen to know exactly where in a program one is. Okay. Other questions? So if we think of our pipeline diagram, the way this is going to work is we're going to have our return. It's going to get to the decode stage. And while it's going through the pipeline, we're going to be setting our bubble signal for the decode stage. So the decode stage keeps getting a no-op instead of whatever junk instruction we're fetching. And we're going to do that until the return finally makes it past the memory stage, and we can fetch the right thing in our fetch stage. So I'd say, how do we implement this in HTLRS? Do I need to like make a counter? And well, we could make a counter. Like we could count 3 cycles in some counter, but we have a better way of doing that. And the observation I'm going to make is that when do we want to set the bubble signal? We want to set it when the fetch is in, when the return is in decode, or in execute, or in memory. That's the point in time when we want the bubble signal set. So during the next cycle, we have a bubble in decode. And we can check for that directly. How can we check for that? Well, we have in our pipeline registers, we have information about the instructions in each stage, including their iCode. So the typical strategy for this is we could just say, is there a return in decode? Is there one in execute? Is there one in memory? By just looking at those pipeline registers. And that would let us implement this logic without doing anything like a counter or something like that. And this strategy is generally what we're going to see. We kind of saw it on the conditional jump, that I didn't like count 3 cycles from when I fetched a jump. Instead, I just said, is there a jump in execute based on the iCode that's in the execute registers? And generally, you'll use the same strategy to handle all our control logic about how do I know if I have a stalling or a forwarding case? I just look at the pipeline registers in each of the stages. I don't like need to like remember something when I decode for later on by counting. I just look at the execute or memory or write back pipeline registers. Questions about this logic? Okay, so far I dealt with setting up our bubble and stall signals. So I'm setting up our pipeline registers, but I mentioned for stalling and prediction, the other thing we need to handle was the PC updates. So I'm going to show you what our PC update looks like as described by our textbook. So something you may observe is that maybe your textbook did not choose the simplest way of building the PC update because they had some particular vision about explaining how prediction works for you. So I'm going to build our PC update, and I'm going to start with our simple case. So you've written this probably more than once now, where we take our program counter, add the length of the instruction, and feed that back into the PC. So that's our base case. Here, that's the normal case. And that's great. But next thing I want to do is I want to implement call, jump, and so on. So I'm going to have a second case for that. We're going to get an immediate value. So this is the value we read from the instruction memory. I'm going to go there instead. And with our strategy of always predicting jumps as taken, this is going to be also what we do for conditional jumps. And in the process, following our textbook, I'm going to rename our PC to our predicted PC, because it's not really the PC, it's the prediction that we're going with. It's usually the actual PC, but not always. Okay, some questions? And so I have a mux on our predicted PC register to choose between those cases based on which instruction we fetched, whether it was a call or a jump or a conditional jump or not. Now, I have to deal with stalls. So for stalls, when I'm stalling an instruction, even though that instruction is decode, that keeps me from fetching a new instruction. We saw when I had my stall here that I was fetching this IRMOVEQ instruction during cycle 2, and I wanted to fetch it again during cycle 3. So to implement that, we're going to need a way of feeding back what the PC is outputting back in without changing it. And we could use the built-in stall F register, stall F signal for this, or we could implement our own MUX. In my reference solution, I prefer implementing my own MUX, but both are workable as long as you know how it interacts with all the other cases for this MUX. So questions about this case? So this is for stalls. We went to fetch the same instruction again. We also might use it on halt to avoid fetching instructions after the halt. That's, you probably did that in a prior assignment, effectively. And we could use this on return if we care about those question mark instructions being not something funny, just to make it easier to figure out what's going on. Okay, so that deals with stalls. But I also had mispredictions, and one thing I need to do on mispredictions is when that prediction was wrong, I need to somehow fetch something else. We don't have a signal to do that yet. And our textbook authors decided to make a choice that mispredictions are going to be corrected at the beginning of the fetch stage rather than at the end of the fetch stage before the new instruction we fetch. So they have the second MUX after the PC register, and they store a prediction that doesn't take into account the correction and correct it at the beginning of that fetch stage. So if we look at our jump prediction case, what they're saying here is that there's going to be a MUX, that this MUX after the PC is going to take effect, in this case during cycle 4, to fetch that subtract instruction from the misprediction being corrected, rather than us deciding to put the subtract instruction in the program counter register, the predicted program counter register. And this is just a choice our textbook authors made, that they decided that they're going to correct it at the beginning of the fetch stage rather than at the end of the previous cycle. Both of these would actually work and produce a processor that does the same thing, just slightly different critical path. And you might say, wait a moment, where do I get that value? So if we think of it, well, that value is what was on this wire here, our instruction address plus instruction length, when we fetch the conditional jump. So what we're going to do is we're going to take this value and we're going to stash it in our pipeline registers. And so we have decode, execute. And then we're going to feed it back. And that's how that's going to work. So we're going to fetch that from a pipeline register where the jump is, typically. And that's how we'll remember what that value is. So questions on that idea of where that our next PC from the jump comes from? The idea that we're going to pass it through the pipeline. Yes, back there? So why does it have to be in the pipeline? So we could store it someplace other than the pipeline, but we potentially have multiple conditional jumps at once, and we want to make sure, you know, we get from the right one. The easiest way to do that is to know it's always in a particular pipeline stages registers, rather than having some sort of scheme like where you have like an array of registers and remember which one. You could do that, but it's easier to use the pipeline registers. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we have one more case, which is our return instruction. So we said how we'd stall for the return instructions, but we said that while we were stalling, we'd be fetching some junk instruction. We have to somehow stop fetching that junk instruction and fetch the right thing. So we need to get the return address from the return. And our textbook, again, chooses to get this at the beginning of the fetch stage of that instruction. So what that means is that this is going to be that our return. We have our data memory getting our return address, and it goes through a pipeline register between memory and write back, and that's what we're feeding back to this mux here. Okay. And annotating that. So, yeah. So the question is, the yellow rectangle labeled predicted PC, is that a register? Yes, that is, if that's what you mean. Drawing all the way to the top right. This is a register, yes. This is the memory to write back pipeline registers. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I note that what I showed here is, this is what our textbook does. I think if I were writing the textbook, I would probably move all the functionality that's in this mux, converge it with this mux, which means we have to get these values from slightly different places, because they wouldn't come from pipeline registers, they come from the inputs to those pipeline registers, because we're in the previous cycle. Because what we're doing here is basically we're saying, you know, during the jump's execute stage, we're going to set things up, but during its memory stage, we're actually going to fetch the right instruction by pulling something from the memory pipeline registers. We could instead say, rather than storing them in the execute to memory pipeline registers, we'll send them to this mux here. That's what I would have done, but what I'm showing you here with these two muxes, so you have something done before, we set the PC and something done after the PC register, I should say, something done after we set the PC register, that's what our textbook authors has decided to do. So our PC register is this, what our textbook authors call our predicted PC, and it's predicted both in the sense that it has a prediction for an instruction that we might have to squash later on, we have to get rid of, and in the sense that sometimes we're going to replace that prediction just before we fetch it with something else. Because it was not correct, you didn't take into account a conditional jump or return its actual result. Okay, so questions about this PC update? Okay. So now we have our full processor, and we know now where we're going to need to stall. And with this design, we need to stall when a memory output is needed to fetch. So that was our, return we're stalling for. And when a memory output is needed in execute, we couldn't induce forwarding. That was our load use hazard. I showed you so far that with mRemoveQ followed by an instruction that like computes on that value, I'd like to note so you don't forget that it also happens with popQ. Pop reads from memory. You can also have that load use hazard situation with a pop. So our net result is our pipeline mostly completes one instruction every cycle, except for load use hazards, where we couldn't use forwarding, so we had to pay an extra cycle, for mispredicted jumps. So we had this two cycle, what I'll call a branch delay penalty for misprediction, and a returns, where we have three cycles of stalling, and we didn't have any solution for predicting returns. We could have predicted something to run, maybe, but there's no good way of making a prediction with what we have in our processor. So I would say real processors, in fact, do predict returns, but we need to store some extra information to do that, which is we haven't bothered doing. So questions? Our overall CPU. So in getting this, most instructions take one cycle, one big assumption we've made is about our data and instruction memory, that we've said that our model is that we have a data memory and an instruction memory, and they're one cycle to access. But if you remember at the beginning of the semester, we said that, oh, we have to talk to memory by going to another chip, sending a message on this bus. That is something we definitely can't do in one cycle. And we said our solution to that is that, well, we're usually going to avoid going to that chip by keeping stuff in a smaller copy of the important parts of memory called a cache. And that copy is going to be something we can access quickly, and hopefully we can almost always use that copy. Why do we hope that? Because we'd like to get that one cycle per access. We'd like the reality not to be that we have this fancy pipeline and it never matters because we have to wait for memory, which is really slow. And our solution is going to be caches. And caches are sort of very important to get reasonable performance. And processor designers spend a lot of effort on that. So as an example, here I have a photograph, a microscope photograph, of a 2004 processor. Why a 2004 processor? Because I could find documentation on what all the parts of this processor were. Also, it's a single core processor. And something more recent, obviously, would be multi-core, which would kind of clutter up this picture. So on this processor, these red boxes are where the registers are. So there's two boxes, because our top red box is our floating point registers. So this is an x86 processor. x86 has a separate registers for floating point from normal general purpose registers. This is common on many processors. So there's a set of floating point registers in the floating point unit at the top of the processor there, and a set of integer registers in the area labeled execution units for the non-floating point instructions. Okay. And you can see, actually, that we have actually relatively little of the processor devoted to our floating point logic. This includes a floating point multiplier, divider, and adder. If you remember 2150, you might think that that's probably not simple. And to our integer execution units, which are here. So this is our ALUs, basically. And a lot of the processor is dedicated to other things. So one of these things is this thing labeled fetch, scan, align microcode. So this does branch prediction, instruction decoding, figuring out different parts of opcodes are, and things like that. And we also have our data and instruction cache, which I've highlighted in orange. And these are what I'll call L1 for level one caches. So this is the boxes that in our model of a processor we've labeled instruction memory and data memory. It's this instruction cache down here and this data cache up here. And also, I guess, there's this thing labeled load store, which is support for the data cache. But the data cache, that's where we actually store our small copy of part of memory so we don't have to go off chip. But this processor, that wasn't good enough. That didn't give us enough performance, having that copy of parts of the memory. And you'll note that this copy is larger than our ALUs. We're actually spending a lot of chip space on this, and that's pretty typical. But that's not good enough. We also have an L2 cache, a level 2 cache, which is basically half the chip. And this situation has gotten more extreme on modern processors. That very commonly, most of the chip space, or at least a very large portion of the chip space, will be devoted to caches, like so. And on a more recent processor, the typical design has also had a level 3 cache. And then we have main memory. And I've kind of drawn them as this sort of pyramid because our registers are small, the smallest of these, but also the fastest. Our L1 cache is slightly bigger, slightly slower, and so on. And if we had an L3 cache, it would be bigger and slower. And then we have main memory. And typical modern timings for these is that registers we expect to be able to access in less than a nanosecond. If we think of a 3 gigahertz processor, we better be able to access the registers every cycle, probably multiple times every cycle. The L1 cache, typical times are in the order of 1 nanosecond. And these times are approximate. They can vary by a factor of 2 or 3, but this is about giving you sort of an order of magnitude impression, not precise numbers. L2 caches are typically 5-ish nanoseconds. And L3s would be typically around 20, you know, again, you know, like plus or minus a factor of 2. And main memory is something like 100. So we have this like 100-fold gap between the speed of registers and main memory, over 100-fold, and between L1 and main memory. And so our hope is that our L1 cache is going to hide this gap, as we'll discuss later. So you might say, if we have this L1 cache and we also have main memory, how does that work? How do we access that? And our L1 cache is typically going to give an interface kind of similar to what we've seen before. And I probably should have a read enable. So here, this is what our data memory interface looks like. We put in an address. We put in an input if we're writing, a value to store. We have a write enable and a read enable signal. And if we're reading, we get a value out. But since this data cache only has a copy of part of memory, sometimes it can't get us the answer right away. And what's going to happen when it can't is that it's going to go to the L2 cache, and the L2 cache is going to go to main L3 and then main memory. So we're still going to have the same kind of interface that we're going to ask the cache for a value, and it's going to get it. Either it's going to get it fast, because it has a copy stored in its own storage, or it's going to get it slow, because it has to go to the next level of cache or to main memory. And to support this, one interface we can have is we can have this extra ready signal. So in the case where it finds the value stored locally, it just sets the ready signal, says, yep, it's done. Otherwise, it wouldn't set it. And what would we do in that case? Well, one thing we could do is we could stall. We could say, well, sorry, was trying to access memory for this instruction, wasn't available, so I'm just going to keep it in the memory stage until it's done. Until our L1 data cache here is finished talking to the L2 cache and getting the value. So questions on this model of how our data cache provide something very similar to a data memory interface, but we have to deal with sometimes accesses take more than one cycle. So the effect of this is that our processor is going to be asking our cache to read and write things, and sometimes our cache is going to need to ask the next level of cache or main memory for it, and other times it's not. And in the case where, for example, here, it asks for the value at address ABCD, and it gets it, our hope would be that if we were to ask it to read ABCD again, that it would answer that without going to the next level again. Hopefully, it would remember it. And that's why we'd hope to get better performance from this than if we were just talking directly to the RAM alone. And our hope is, in fact, that often enough when the processor asks the cache for a value, that it's going to have it, that we're going to get the performance as if we had the speed of that cache. So if our cache takes a nanosecond for an answer, I guess I should mention, I gave you these timings. These are latency timings. Throughput's a little more complicated. So if I ask for a value, I get an answer back in a nanosecond all the time. So it would be as fast as that L1 cache. But to make this happen, you know, we're going to need to hide the difference between the latency of the L1 cache and main memory. If that's 100x difference, that means we need to have our value be found in the cache, you know, over 99% of the time, or else we're going to really notice the impact of going to main memory. So even if it's not super common, you know, if it takes 100 times longer and it happens once every 20 times, we're going to really slow things down. That's not good enough. We need like a what we'll call a hit rate, the amount of time that the value actually is in our cache, to be, you know, ideally over 99% in effect, to like hide that sort of difference. We also want to provide, however, the capacity of those largest memory. We want it to be the case that, you know, I still get good performance, when I program has megabytes of data it's dealing with, gigabytes of data it's dealing with, because that's why I have gigabytes of memory, so I can deal with gigabytes of data. And it really seems like these goals are in conflict. How can we have lots of data being stored in this small memory, this small cache, and get both good performance from the small cache and good capacity when, you know, that doesn't seem possible? And in general, it's not possible. Of course we can't do that. But there's something about typical programs that are going to let us get away with this. And these are assumptions we make when we design our memory hierarchies, our set of caches and main memory that are going to allow us to do this. And there's two big assumptions about programs we're going to make that we're going to call temporal locality and spatial locality. So temporal locality is the idea that if I access a value now, it's going to be accessed again too. So if that's how our programs work, caches can take advantage of this. How do we take advantage of it? When I see you access a value, I want to store it. Because it's likely that storing it's going to pay me off later when you access it again. So if our programs have this property of temporal locality, that's going to work out great. If they don't, well, too bad. We store values we didn't care about. That's going to be bad. But hopefully they'll have this property. That will help us. And the other big property is spatial locality. So if I access a value now, I'm going to access adjacent values near in the near future. So what do I mean by adjacent values? I mean ones with nearby addresses. So if we think of fetching an instruction, I'm likely to fetch the instruction after it, at the next address. Or we think of fetching an element of an array, I'm likely to fetch the next thing in the array soon. So this is another thing that we can build caches to take advantage of. When I fetch a value from memory, I don't just fetch that value, I can fetch a bunch of nearby values and store them in advance, so next time you won't have to wait for them. They'll be already there, because I will have anticipated that you're likely to get it, so I'll just get all these values, you know, this big chunk of this array or this machine code for you. So these are both properties that we hope are just things our programs do, that when our program accesses a value, it's likely to access it again soon. I can write programs where these aren't true. But the reason why we get away with caches, why caches are so useful, is that these are just naturally true of typical programs, that when you write a program, it's going to have temporal locality and it's going to have spatial locality even if you're not trying. That you don't have to do anything, you just end up writing programs that have both of these properties. And you might say, is that just dumb luck? Is that, you know, because we've been teaching you algorithms which have these properties just because we got used to computers like this? No, that's, you know, it's just very natural. And a way of illustrating that is to look at typical code that involves a loop. So here we have a compute mean function. And this function has tons of examples of temporal and spatial locality that just occur naturally. So first I'm going to look at machine code. So in the machine code, here we have a loop. That loop is fetched over and over again from memory. When I access the instruction for the plus equals operation in the loop once, I'm likely to access it again in the near future. That's not always true, but that's usually true. That's usually, if I told you I just did the plus equals operation, it's usually a good guess that I'm likely to do that in the next few instructions. I'm likely to fetch that again. I also have spatial locality. If I told you I fetched the instruction for total equals zero, I'm likely to fetch the instruction after that, which is probably part of the for loop. That we can make good guesses about what instructions will fetch, you know, based on looking at adjacent addresses. So we have good spatial locality. And that just happened naturally when I wrote this code. And it actually seems like it would actually be very awkward to like do something like compute a mean without having these properties in our machine code. We'd have to like add bogus jumps or something. Like it wouldn't actually make sense. We also have good temporal locality and spatial locality in our data accesses. So we have variables total I and length. If these were stored in memory, We're reaccessing them over and over again. If you see me writing to Turtle, it's a good guess that I'm going to write to it again. So these all have good temporal locality, that when I do a write or read from them, I'm likely to do a write or read from them again in the near future. So as a cache, if I store those values we're accessing, that's going to pay off well in terms of making sure accesses use cache and don't go to main memory. I also have good spatial locality in my array, that even though I only access each array element once, which seems bad for caches, right? Because caches are about storing things for reuse. But because when I access values of I, I'm going to access values of I plus 1, we have spatial locality. And our cache can take advantage of that if when we ask for values of I, it also fetches values of I plus 1 plus 2 plus 3. And even though I'm only accessing that array once, we can still have a good hit rate on it. Good amount of time, then the access goes to cache and doesn't actually involve talking to memory and doing that high latency operation. So questions on the types of spatial and temporal locality we have here? Yes? So the question is, how would a cache take advantage of this? Take advantage of the spatial locality?
Is it like specific to the direction of the counter, or is it going to have equal amounts of the array on either side of the
So the question is, to take advantage of the spatial locality, are we going to like fetch equal values of array around the accesses? So there are multiple ways that real caches try to take advantage of spatial locality like this. The primary way we're going to talk about is that we're going to fetch fixed size blocks of data, and we're going to do that in the way which is most convenient computationally. So we're just going to make them be like a multiple of 64 or something like that. And they'll just end up containing multiple array elements. But real processors have done other strategies that we might allude to briefly, like they might explicitly say, oh, you're accessing address 1000, 1004, 1008. That seems like a pattern. I'm going to fetch 1012, 1016, and so on. That's another strategy that's pretty easy to implement, actually. And you could also do strategies like say, oh, you fetch 1,000, I'm going to fetch 1,004 through 1,030, just because I'm just going to add, assuming you're going in that direction. So all of those are valid strategies, and all of those are ways of taking advantage of spatial locality. We're primarily going to talk about sort of the simplest possible way, which is just that we're going to make sure we fetch a big chunk, and we're not going to be particularly careful about whether that's the best big chunk we could fetch. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so this is on temporal and spatial locality. So this is what we're taking advantage of. And our topic for next time is going to be what's a simple way of building caches that do this. So we know we want to store things that were recently accessed, and we know we want to store more than one thing at a time. So I'm going to talk about probably the simplest possible cache design, at least one view of it, which is going to be a direct map cache, where basically we're going to say I'm going to have some amount of space for cache values. In this case, I have 8 bytes. And I'm going to divide that up into blocks. In this case, I've arbitrarily chosen those blocks are 2 bytes. Why not 2 bytes and not one? Well, the bigger the blocks, the more we'll be able to take advantage of spatial locality. The bigger the blocks, the harder it's going to be to take advantage of temporal locality because I just have less slots to put things in. So there's going to be less things I'll be able to keep. Okay. And our topic for next time will be, well, if I have my cache organized like this, and some program asks the cache to read this address, where do I put that in my cache? Where do I look for that? And what bookkeeping do I need to do that? And so that's what our topic will be next time. We're going to show a very simple design for a cache where we do the bookkeeping to store these 8 bytes in a way where we can efficiently look them up and efficiently store things there.